Okay, welcome to this next talk, which is Wednesday. Wednesday morning talk, day number something of our retreat. And as you may have noticed throughout this retreat on the morning talks, I've always been focusing on just on meditation and nothing else. But sometimes in other retreats, people just talk about all sorts of different dharmas. But I'm really focusing this retreat on one thing, and that's the development of the mind. And I do this for a purpose, because keeping on the same topic all the time reinforces what I've said so far. It talks about it from a different angle. It encourages, it brings these things to mind, and so by continually brainwashing on the same thing, there's a good chance that the mind does get into deeper, more peaceful states than one has ever had before. Sometimes it's very tempting when you're giving Dharma talks to talk about all sorts of other theoretical things. But here I try to keep it just on the experience of peace, the experience of bliss, the experience of freedom. Simply because that all the other theories you can argue with. But experience is something which is personal, which you can never argue with. In fact, those deep experiences are what is the most valuable part of the spiritual practice. Because you get the experience first, and then you get the descriptions and the theories afterwards. If you try and develop the theories first, it usually bends the experience to fit, and thereby you're not really arriving at truth. So here we go into the deep, bare experience of what's possible through meditation. And already some of you have got some experiences, maybe not jhanas yet, but some experiences, and just the magic of this mind and what it can do and how it's achieved, all of which is where one gets the great insights from. But the insights here I'm going to talk about later. Here, the one subject which I've approached but haven't talked about, but which is very important, is the jhanas themselves. Exactly what are they? Why are they? And what do they really mean? I mentioned this jhana business simply because there are some people who have had some experiences before, and at the time they didn't even know they were jhanas. Sometimes they're even discouraged and considered to be just a waste of time. But in particular, because of the confusion which those immense experiences generated, they don't develop them and they don't repeat them, and they tend to sort of push them aside. And so it's important to give really good descriptions of what these things are, understand their place in the path to enlightenment, understand their place in the religions of the world, and also gives you that encouragement. And if what does happen at one time, one will know exactly what's going on, one will be able to deal with it in a wise way, and maybe even use it for the seed of enlightenment. So what actually are these jhanas? As you're meditating in the same way that you've been meditating so far, there comes a time when you press the right buttons and the mind gets very still. It's nearly always unexpected. You're sitting down quite often at the most unpromising times. You sit down there, and because it's unpromising, because you don't expect anything, you tend to be able to let go with more efficiency. You don't try so hard. Basically, you give up, okay, well, another hour to go towards lunch, who cares, I might as well sit anyway. And with those sorts of attitudes of not striving, of not trying anything, not expecting, you have a greater chance of going into deep meditation. You ask exactly why you get into deep meditation at that time, and a lot of it is the momentum you built up in the past. You've been trying to let go, but not really doing it, but there's something inside which understands that letting go is the path. And you get into a little bit of right meditation, correct meditation, when you do actually let go. You do relax, you do take off the fingers from the buttons and the hands from the levers, and you do allow the mind just to go inside. And when you do it, you find it so easy, and it's so peaceful, and it's so blissful. And you get into this first rewards from letting go. Some of you have tried watching the breath, and it is so difficult, but when you do it correctly, you start doing letting go. You just sit there, and the breath is just there, and you can just hold it without any effort whatsoever, and it's just right in front of you, it doesn't move. thinking, wow, this is easy, this is so nice and so peaceful and so beautiful. And that reward there gives you the incentive to carry on the same path, to do the same again, only more, to let go even more. And as you let go even more, just the breath disappears and the body disappears. And sometimes people get fear at those stages. And it's the fear of letting go of something which one is attached to. Each of the fears which come up in meditation, in one sense, should be expected as par for the course. Every time you come across an attachment, what you think you own, what is part of you, your personality, who you think you are, when that's about to be taken away, it does give rise to a fear, like the fear of a death of part of you. You're letting go of something. The point being that once you get the momentum of letting go, that fear just cannot withstand the current. You just go deeper into it. You're afraid or not, who cares? And the other the other thing, as well as the momentum of letting go, is the sheer joy of it. It becomes so much fun that you're willing to trade, sort of losing some attachments. You're willing to go through the fear because it's just too much enjoyment. You just allow yourself to go deeper, even though it's a bit scary at first. And as you go deeper into these stages of letting go, the body does disappear, and you're quite happy to have it disappear. The thinking disappears, and you're quite happy to have a mind which can't give any orders. These great limiters appear in the mind, and you're just quite happy just to be with them, even though they're some of the most powerful things you've ever seen in your life. Just incredibly strong, blissful and radiant. You're able just to leave them alone. Basically, you're losing control in a very beautiful way. The controller is dying. So these are like a death. In the same way, out-of-the-body experiences, a death of the body and the five senses. Here it's a voluntary death. What's actually dying, what's disappearing, is your body, the five senses of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. And there's something else dying which is even more scary. It's the potential to do, your will. This doer which I've been spending such a long time talking about, that just cuts off. It's scary because we think that that's the one possession which is most important to us. Our free will, our choice, our ability to manage our own life, especially our inner world. And to have someone take that away is very scary. The point is, it's not some being taken away. It's just the whole thing stops. And if you can allow it to stop, allow this doer to stop, the thing which keeps the mind moving, which stops it becoming still, that is removed. And the nature is to become absolutely still. For the mind to become peaceful for a change. And I mean really peaceful. The point is the cause for all movement, the cause for all restlessness, the cause for even the mind to tremble has been taken away. The will, the doer. When that doer finally stops, you know, it's called a jhana. And these jhanas are very strange states. Within the jhana itself, with any jhana, you can't do anything, which is a strange situation to be in, because there you are fully aware, brightly aware, ecstatically aware. The awareness is stronger than it's ever been before. I mentioned superpower mindfulness before to you, but in the jhana it's super duper power mindfulness. It goes up many levels of intensity. But the point is, it's frozen. Because it's frozen, this usual ability, or the usual way of knowing, which is like a discriminative knowing, we compare things, that's how we know what's what. We look at it from different angles to get a perspective on it. Because of the very deep stillness of the mind in a jhana, that perspective has disappeared. You've only got one angle on things. A simile which I gave some years ago, and when you get into these jhanas, it's excruciatingly difficult to get similes, because this is like another world, which has very, very little in common with the ordinary world of our five senses. But nevertheless, I do remember as a child, on some of these TV game shows, they'll put a picture up for the viewers at home to see of an object which had been photographed from a strange angle. And you were asked to write in or phone in to see what you thought that object was. A still photograph, I remember one, was just a pencil, which is actually photographed the point on. And so all it looked like was like an eye with a black thing in the middle surrounded by a bit of white. And the point is, it was an unusual angle, and because you couldn't move it, it was a photograph, it was very hard to decide exactly what it was. And that was a simile, the best simile I can get or give you for what the experience of the jhanas are like. They are so still. You've only got one perspective. It's hard to find out what exactly it is, to give it much descriptions, especially at the time. So because of that, the first time one gets into some of these jhanas, it's very hard for you to understand what's going on. The only thing is that when one emerges, when the mind can move again, that's when one says, wow, that was amazing, that was incredible, what the heck was that? It's only after emerging from the jhanas one can actually really find out what they truly are, or which one you were in. However, with experience, you get to understand what these jhanas are and what's happening. Because when you move from the nimitta into the jhana, again, it just happens. You cannot give any instructions at this point. The very idea of doing something or deciding now I'll get into jhana is completely ridiculous. All those thoughts, that movement of the mind, which you look upon as being thinking, giving instructions, has long since quietened down and disappeared. It is absolutely still, and it just happens. It's a progress, a natural progress. But within those jhanas, there's, especially the first jhana, is something which is very important to understand, that what you're focusing on, your object, is just sheer bliss. This is what fills the mind up. In the same way that when you are having your lunch, your mind is filled with the food in front of you. Or when you're doing breath meditation, your mind soon becomes filled with the breath. That's what you're aware of. The experience of the breath. When you see the nimitta, what you're experiencing is this beautiful light. In the jhanas, especially the first jhana, what you're experiencing is bliss. Afterwards, when you come out, you say, what was that? What was the main object? What was I watching? What was I aware of? It's bliss you're aware of. That is the object of the mind. It's interesting to be clear on these things. Because when we say we take up a meditation object, we have to know exactly what we're doing. This is what one is aware of. This is what fills the mind. If you're thinking, you're not aware of the meditation object. You're aware of the thoughts. If you're watching the tip of the nose, you're not watching the breath. You're watching the nose, the body. You have to be very precise to understand about these objects of meditation. When the Buddha said, watch the breath, that's what you're doing. You're watching the breath. Nothing else. When you're watching a nimitta, you're just watching a nimitta. You're not watching the edges of a nimitta. You're not watching the words. There's no words there. If a thought comes up, what should I be doing? You're watching the thoughts. You're not watching the nimitta. So in these stages, the nimitta is there all the time, not moving. Your mind is not being distracted going anywhere else. Just on this one thing. And the nimitta experiences afterwards, you ask yourself, what was that? You're just watching a light. A very brilliant, beautiful light. But the descriptions are not the thing. You just bear experience. And so when you get into these jhanas, you're just watching the bliss. Observing, that's the object of your mind. The point is that in these experiences, the bliss fills the mind up so much, it's so strong and attractive, it keeps your mind right on it. But of course, effort is completely redundant. The doing is completely stopped here. You can't do anything. If the mind starts to move that much, you're straight out again. But in particular, because the mind is just so in itself, and the bliss is so strong. The whole body has disappeared, and the body is not available for you anymore. You literally cannot feel your body. You cannot hear sounds. All of these things are just turned off. And what you're left with is a pure experience of mind. The body no longer exists for you. That by itself is a wonderful experience which you can use for insight for hours and hours and hours, because it shows you just how unnecessary is this body, how unnecessary is seeing and hearing and feeling. But in particular, the sheer bliss of these experiences, you understand after much going in and out of these jhanas, you understand that the reason why they are so blissful, that the cause of the happiness is simply the fact the five senses and the body are no longer there. You understand that these are the irritants. These are a great source of what the Buddha called dukkha. And the point being that if you've never let go of those five senses, if the body's never disappeared, if you've always had this body, always had these five senses, you cannot realize how much suffering they are. A simile is like a person born in a prison, who's grown up in a prison, spent all their life in a prison. They get used to prison. They think that's ordinary. They don't know anything else other than a prison. So they can never know that prison is suffering. It's normal for them. But one day they may be able to go outside the prison into the clean, clear freedom. And only then do they realize, my goodness, I've been in prison all this life and never realized it. They understand from that point on how prison is suffering. We don't realize just how we're imprisoned by our five senses and by our body. But the first taste of freedom in a jhana, you will know. And never again will you look upon this body and these five senses as being such a source of delight anymore. Never again will you look upon prison as being fun and games. Trouble is, there's so many other people in the prison, you just hang out with other prisoners and you go out celebrating prison life. Yeah, prison ain't all that bad. We get a movie every now and again, we can have sex, we can go, if we work really hard, we can get a really big prison cell. Your big mansion. You can get a little car to go from prison cell to prison cell, within the prison, of course. You can't get out. You can even fly, you know, in an aircraft within the prison, but you never get out. And we think, oh, what a wonderful place prison is. And we talk with other prisoners, and it's only every now and again some guy comes and visits prison who's been outside and says, hey, there's another world outside this prison. There's freedom. And they say, oh, we don't believe you. There's no such thing as jhanas. Said, yeah, there's a whole world outside these five senses and the body. Yeah, we know you guys. You're just averse to prison life. There's something wrong with you. You're just averse to relationships and sex. You're perverted. You're something wrong with you. You're not enjoying prison. You're depressed. Whatever it is. But the point is that once you get out of prison for the first time, it changes the whole perspective, the whole way you look at things. So within that first jhana, which happens naturally, you're just experiencing a bliss which has nothing to do with the five senses. Because it's nothing to do with the five senses, that's why it's so difficult to describe. Because our whole language, our vocabulary is built up with the bricks of the five sense world. This is how we make our language from ordinary people's experience. And because not too many people have the common experience of jhanas, the language is very difficult. So we say it's a bliss, but it's a bliss not of this world, a deep bliss, and a great stillness as well. Remember, the mind is hardly moving at all, and there's no will. It's a completely different ball game. So you're going into a weird state of consciousness, which when you come out afterwards, if you don't get someone to explain it to you, you just know, what the heck was that? That was beautiful, that was good, that was marvelous. The effects afterwards are just incredible. Beautiful love, power, energy, brightness, don't want to sleep. You know that was big and huge, but you need someone to describe it to you. And the best description is the absence, what's not there. In this first jhana, when it happens, is the bliss gets so strong. Remember what I was saying about the energy going into the knowing and the doer being starved of energy. In this particular time, the doer disappears. So all the energy just flows into the knowing, and that's where the bliss is coming from. No body, no senses, no will. The mind gets incredibly energized, superpowered. And that bliss is so strong. But at first, what happens is this mind of yours still hasn't given up its grasping. Every time you see something, I've mentioned this, you tend to interfere with it. Every time you watch the breath, the first time you watch the breath, it's not a natural breath. You interfere with it and make it shake. Every time that you go into your room, so for the first time you go into the room, you interfere with it and make it this way and that way. It's a strange thing that human beings, even if we go into a wilderness, go up a mountain for the first time, this pristine, beautiful, natural wilderness of a mountaintop, we go and put a flag on top of it. That's what we did with the moon. They go up there and they put a flag there. Can't they leave things alone? And the answer is no. The very same reason that mountaineers want to put a flag at the top. Well, they don't put a flag, put a rock to make a cairn. Is they always want to interfere with things. It's so difficult for us to see and experience something without messing it up. And that habit still has a residue in the first jhana. You've got this incredible, amazing bliss. You interfere with it, slightly. It's called grasping. So you've got this beautiful bliss, and the mind clings onto it. Because of that clinging onto it, that's a cause of the disturbance. The bliss, in my vocabulary, wobbles. The mind recedes from it. That little bit of doing, subverbal, it's just the movement of the mind. That amount of movement is enough to take the mind just a tiny bit away from the bliss. But the bliss is just too strong to let the mindfulness disappear. It pulls it straight back into it. This is what I call the wobble of the first jhana. It's just the subconscious interference of the mind, always grasping and doing things, holding on to things. That causes the wobble of the first jhana. Huge amounts of bliss, but you can't see that it's wobble at first. Sometimes I've mentioned that the only time you can really understand what this first jhana is to be able to achieve a second jhana. Because then again, you've got a perspective to understand what first jhana is. In the same way, the only time you can really understand what prison is to leave prison for the first time. The only time you can truly understand what the first jhana is to gain the experience of the second. Because in the second jhana, that wobble has disappeared. There you are absolutely still. When I say absolutely, even the first jhana looks so still. Without any experience of what's deeper, you think that's the absolute, that's the max. You can't get more peaceful than that. But you can. And in that second jhana, it's sometimes described as like rock-like samadhi, diamond-like samadhi, like the mind being a mountain, immovable, doesn't even tremble even the slightest. The reason why this happens is that soon, the mind, it's not you, you've disappeared at this stage. The mind just has confidence that it doesn't need to interfere with that beautiful bliss. You can just leave it completely alone and it will stay by itself. You don't need to do the last bit of holding. In a Pali they call it ajatang sampasadana, the inner confidence. It makes an important point here about this confidence. It's the same word like as inner joy. That when one has enough joy and confidence, then one can truly let go. Faith sometimes helps you let go. Which is why that in some theistic traditions, sometimes some of the Christian mystics would have so much faith in an ultimate being, they could let go of their will. to surrender to a God. That degree of absolute surrender of themselves, giving up the will, might be enough to get them into that such deep states of meditation. They become the mystics. Union with a God. Union with an ultimate. Because certainly anyone who's experienced one of those jhanas, if you don't come from a Buddhist tradition but a theistic tradition, is so obvious as why you say, wow, you've just been with a God. You have disappeared. The energies are immense. The beauty is otherworldly. This is what it feels like. The most powerful, selfless, incredible experience of your existence. It is why these jhanas are bona fide mystical experiences. And if you get one of these jhanas and you are in another religion, you probably call you a saint. However, in the Buddhist tradition, you think, no, there's still more to do. Carry on. So here we get these beautiful blisses. The second jhana, because you completely let go, there's no more movement of the mind. Therefore, you go to an absolute state of stillness. I want you to actually to think about what stillness can mean. A lot of times that we can contemplate stillness and it's still very, very rough and coarse. When there's nothing to shake the mind left, all that which can move the mind is gone. It's absolutely still, no movement possible at all. And that's why in this second jhana, one of the prominent features of it is what I call the complete absence of the potential to do. Call it the potential to do because you can sit down here in this room and you can let go of your will. But you're only letting go of it, sort of taking your hand off the steering wheel, as it were, but you're not throwing away the steering wheel. You know you can still actually put your hands on the levers and control at any moment. Here in the second jhana, there's no potential anymore. You can't do anything. There's no steering wheel, there's no levers, there's no buttons left to push. They're all gone. That's why it's the weird experience of that which we call will, doer, choice, is so vanished, is completely absent. And there you are, fully aware, without the possibility to do something. From that point onwards, you'll understand just the nature of this thing called choice, will. It's got nothing to do with the self. It's not you who chooses or wills to do things. Because you're there in experience where all this has completely vanished. You realize it's not essential to you anymore. It's like suddenly sort of you look in the mirror and you haven't got a head anymore. Your head's just vanished. It's been chopped off and thrown in the dustbin. But you're still there. Completely aware, normal, even actually better than normal. Then you feel, find out this head is not valuable anymore. It's not necessary anymore. This head, which I thought was essential to my life, is not. Same with this will. You find out this will is not important. It's not me. It doesn't come from me. That, of course, blows you away afterwards. Every time I tell this about will and non-self, people get scared. Because there's attachments in the same way that you get scared at certain stages in the meditation. Because you're about to let go of something you think is mine and it's an essential. Just like the person coming to steal the ice cream from the baby. Nah, you don't need that. And when it disappears, it's much better. It's more bliss and more freedom. So even though these are the states of deep stillness, they're also noted by their sense of incredible freedom, peace and bliss. The difference between the second jhana and the first jhana is in the second jhana is absolutely still. The first jhana has still got some movement. In the first jhana it is a bliss because the senses have gone for the first time. The five senses. The mind is what's left. Now you know what the mind is. You're right with it for hours. In the second jhana, it's the bliss of actually stillness. At last, the world isn't moving anymore. Everything is frozen, still, solid. That's a huge amount of bliss. You find that the movement is suffering. And the will causes that suffering. The will makes everything shake. And then when that's gone, it's this incredible peace. That peace, that stillness, when nothing moves, that is bliss. As one goes deeper, deeper into just letting go, what's happening here is just the mind is starts to let go of its objects. First of all, the mind was moving. Now, as it goes in, the bliss refines. In that third jhana, just in the middle of the second jhana, like the second jhana is in the middle of the first jhana, like a house with rooms built like circles. The next room is within this one, and the room afterwards, you have to go through the inner rooms, like concentric circles, to get to the next one. You have to go inwards, never onwards, never to the left or to the right, always going in. And one goes inwards, just the bliss changes. The object of the mind is how you know which jhana you were in. What type of bliss, what flavor. Sometimes people think they know what happiness is, what joy is, what pleasure is. Until you've had experience of the jhanas, you've only got a fraction of the information of what pleasure and joy are. That's why sometimes people talk about the heavenly realms. And these heavenly realms be so much more blissful and more beautiful than the human realms. But beyond our conception, here in this human body, or rather using this human body, you can actually access those pleasures and those bliss. You go from a deeper and deeper bliss, a more profound. If you just get into a first jhana, again you think, surely there can't be anything more than this. But you do get more than that. The stages of bliss get even more profound, more intense. In the third jhana, it's a different type of bliss. It's something which has disappeared. For those of you who read these things in the books, you'll find out that in the third jhana, what we call piti, which is half of pleasure, has faded away. Here the feeling of pleasure is disappearing. And you think, that is that pleasure disappearing? No, it's a more refined thing which is left afterwards. In the third jhana, half of it disappears. In the fourth jhana, the other half disappears. And you're left with what's called perfect equanimity. And sometimes, well, you lost all your bliss, isn't that suffering? No, because in those fourth jhanas you realize even that bliss is an affliction. Now you have what's called, when happiness and joy disappear, you have the happiness which is free of happiness. It's called upeka sukha, the happiness of equanimity. Sometimes you do sound like a Zen master saying all these koans, joy at last, and now there's no happiness in the world. The biggest bliss is when all bliss disappears. But this is how the experience works. This is what happens. This is how you describe it. Even more bliss than before, when you find that what you took to be happiness is coarse. When that disappears, you get something even more delicious. In that state of equanimity, that's when mindfulness does reach its peak. Here the mind is its brightest, its clearest, its most powerful. Here the knower can never be more strong than in the fourth jhana. There's two parts of the self, the knower and the doer, remember. These jhanas are not enlightenment simply because one is still knowing these things, and it's very easy to think that that knower is your essential self, that which knows, consciousness. However, that if one continues on this path of letting go, one goes into what's called the immaterial jhanas. But I should pause a little bit, because if you just get into the fourth jhana, that's enough to get you enlightened. When you come out, you look back afterwards, reflect on what's going on. There's enough data there to see all the rest of the way into emptiness. Going back to the simile of the thousand-petal lotus, you're right now into the very innermost petals. As I mentioned in that simile, The deeper you go into any flower, the petals become more fragrant, but also more refined, more delicate. And those innermost petals are, as it were, so thin, even though there's four petals still between you and Nirvana, it's very easy to see right the way through. You can see the emptiness in the middle. But even this knower is not you, not me, not a self. Just a process. However, if you want to open those innermost petals, this is interesting what happens next. Here, it's not so much bliss is the object of the mind, but just a single perception. Here you're getting into a very, very refined state of consciousness. The mind is so still, it can hold one perception without moving for hours upon hours. The deeper you get, because there's less to move the mind, you actually stay so long. If it's in a fourth jhana, it has to be several hours. There's no way you can just get into a fourth jhana for a few minutes or even just an hour. It's too stable. You can't come out. It just lasts. You get into these immaterial states, maybe even days. What happens here in these immaterial states? The mind just gets this perception. The first immaterial state is, they call it the base. It's usually translated as the base of infinite space. Infinite is one possible meaning of the word, but the true meaning is more like unbounded, unlimited, unmeasured, uncircumscribed space. To understand what that means, again, getting a simile from your life, and you have to get a simile from your early meditation experiences. And I use that preliminary stage of the present moment awareness to give you some indication of what these immaterial states are. Because many of you have had those stages of present moment awareness in its fullness. If you have the present moment awareness in its fullness, it's just this one moment now. And if you look at it from one perspective, it's just like sandwiched between the past and the future, this little slit, which is, you know, so thin, you wonder that, you know, how you can ever sort of live in such a state. Because the majority of the past, all the future, just pressing in on this moment, it seems almost zero time. But as soon as you get into the present moment awareness, the experience, not from outside, but from inside, is having all the time in the world. When you're in the present moment, because time has no meaning, it's infinite. In the same way, if you get in to this first immaterial jhana, space has no more meaning. It's both no space and an infinity of space. In the same way, the present moment is no time, but all the time in the world. Time has no meaning. When you stop measuring it, when you stop bounding it with past and future, space becomes unbound. What happens when you get into present moment awareness? You call it present moment, you call it like unbounded time if you want. First of all, that's your experience. And then time disappears. It has no more meaning for you. What these immaterial states are is like perceptions, which form the objects of your consciousness, which maintain the consciousness. Those perceptions start to vanish, one after another. In the first attainment, space starts to vanish. The whole idea of extension has gone. Next stage is the stage of infinite consciousness. This is like what you know has disappeared. Now the knowing starts to disappear. In this state of infinite consciousness, you know the knower. That knower becomes unbounded. The knower disappears. Now it becomes very hard to describe this, but please see if you can follow. When, same like time disappears, in the present moment. In the second state, consciousness disappears. But you're conscious that consciousness has disappeared. The object is gone, but that which is watching is still there, as it were. So from that, you get into the consciousness of nothing, the third immaterial attainment, because the mind is disappearing stage after stage. What you're aware of is nothing, but you're still aware. As that, what you're aware of, informs what's being aware, the consciousness turns off even more. What you're now perceiving is no perception at all, but you're perceiving no perception. From the point of view of the subject, there's perception. From the point of view of the object, there's no perception, which is why it is called the stage of neither perception nor non-perception. The mind is becoming so subtle, it's very hard to say whether you exist in this state or you don't exist. Almost like a phantom world where the consciousness is so refined, the last petal is so thin, it hardly exists at all. This is the last flicker of existence. Once that disappears, one attains the cessation of all perception and all consciousness. This is where the mind stops, true emptiness. This is as far as you can go. Here everything ends and stops. An experience of full nibbana here and now. Then it comes back again, reversing one's steps as perception starts to grow again. First seeing nothing, not perception, then seeing nothing, then seeing consciousness, then seeing space, then going through the jhanas backwards. This is what happens in the path of letting go. These are what those jhanas are. During these stages, you will not have a clue what's going on. In a sense, you will not be able to make any judgments, any assessments, not being able to take notes. During the stages, if you can actually say this is third jhana, or this is fourth, or this is a material state, if you can say that, you know for sure that's not a jhana. If you can say when you're in one of these states, ah, what is this? Then you know that is not a jhana. You can't say anything. Please get some understanding that these are weird and strange and deep states of stillness. Certain things you just cannot do. They're beyond the ability in those stages. But what happens when one emerges backwards, goes out through the first jhana, back into this ordinary consciousness, when the mind can move again? That is when one looks back and says, wow, that was immense. What the hell was that? And I mentioned that, I mean, it's an expletive, but these are the most expletive states you've ever experienced. Sometimes people say, oh, should you go and review these states? You've got no choice. The biggest thing in the world, you can't ignore it and just go back to work, or just go and have a cup of coffee, or just watch your favorite movie on the TV. No way you could do things like that. You just had this jhana, or I don't know which jhana it was. You just go, wow, what the heck was that? And you just go looking at it. Sometimes that just the bliss after a jhana can block you from reviewing for a while. Because after these jhanas, when you emerge, you don't just emerge cold. Just the mind has been so empowered that you come out with that power as well. The mind is sometimes, the body is shaking sometimes just with joy. And you just can't move sometimes. Sometimes you see some people coming out afterwards and you just got to be very careful with them. Like a very cool glass. You shouldn't never pour hot water into a cool glass. They become completely unable to speak or do anything except look at you with wide eyes and just say with their eyes, wow. We know what they've been through, you can understand. You just very gentle, tell them not to struggle. Just allow the consciousness to come back to its normal state again. Doesn't matter how long it takes. and where they finished blissing out. You know, under the story of the Buddha, that after he became enlightened under the Bodhi tree, they say he just spent about 7 days just looking at the Bodhi tree without moving. I can understand that. That's not an exaggeration. If you get into one of these jhanas, you can imagine you can just spend 1 hour just looking at that post over there without blinking, completely blissed out of your head and just unmoving and just zonked. So imagine if that full enlightenment, the Buddha under the Bodhi tree. So when a person comes out, just treat them very gently. Allow them to come back. The deeper they've been in, the longer it'll take them to come back again. They're perfectly healthy. There's no danger. They're not going to go crazy. In fact, they'll be the most sane they've ever been in their whole life. Only that sometimes worldly people are crazy and can't recognize their sanity. So what happens when they come out, just leave them alone. Leave yourself alone for a while. And when you've finished blissing out, you look back upon those states and you'll never be able to forget them. Not throughout your whole life. Simply because they're the most powerful. I sometimes use the word they're traumatic in the sense that a trauma is usually a negative experience but it leaves an indelible imprint on your mind. As many psychologists know. These are even more intense but entirely positive. And because of their intensity, just like the negative traumas, you cannot forget them. So this is incredibly positive, you will never be able to forget those. So it's very easy to bring them up to your consciousness and just investigate them. What is that? What was that? Why was that? What did I do? What was happening in that state? And you can recall them very clearly. And this is where you find out what they were. This is when you look at them and you see, what was happening there? And that's when you ask, was I feeling the body? Did I know any sounds? Sometimes other people will tell you that they shook you. They shouted at you, come out. It's time for lunch. You just can't hear anything. You find out that you know your body was completely disappeared. And you ask, what type of bliss, what was I experiencing at the time? Maybe you can understand what I mean by the wobble, because you can see the mind is pulsing a little bit, or the experience pulsing. So, that must have been the first jhana. Sometimes, just a solid peace and stillness of the bliss. That must be a second or above jhanas. You can see the two different types of bliss. Full bliss of the second, where half of it, much more superior, much more subtle, in the third jhana. Or maybe you've seen those blisses completely disappear. That's a fourth jhana. Here you get some understanding of what these states are. I know it does actually say in one sutta there that you should just practice the first jhana before going to the second jhana, but I don't know, that doesn't make any sense to me. When you let go, you let go. Sometimes you just go deep into the deeper jhanas. You go through the first, second, third, fourth very quickly. Sometimes your power of letting go is not that big, so you just get into the first jhana. But it's very hard to say, this is the one I'm going to go to. Just let go as much as you can, and this is what happens. And once you've experienced any of these jhanas, you understand how refined and how powerful this meditation can be. Sometimes people just scratch the surface. One day you scratch so deep, you get to the underlying essence of things. Not only is it the most powerful experience you can have, next to full enlightenment itself, but it also gives you all the data you require. The strange, weird things which happen and why they happen. Then you can really understand the teachings of the Buddha. Without those samadhi experiences, you just really haven't got enough to fully understand what the Buddha was on about. Why the Buddha sort of left his son and his wife. Why the Buddha just renounced everything. You may have some romantic ideas about renunciation. You may have some intellectual ideas about truth and freedom. But unless one's had those experiences, that's all they are. Just ideas. Once you have the experience, it blows all your ideas apart. With the power of true experiential knowledge. That's why these jhanas are so important. If you just get one, that's enough to change your life. which is why I encourage meditation in this way, to get your jhana, because that's worth 1,000,000,000 talks. You can read all the books you like. One jhana will blow all those books apart, as you actually start to see where those books came from. Go to the source. So this is what the jhanas are all about. Don't think that you can't do this. Many people have thought that, not me. And then one day they're sitting there in the corner, and sam bam boom, they're writing. And after, you can't get excited when you're in there. You don't know what's going on, just having a great time. And it's afterwards. See, you can do it too. It's always nice when someone gets those jhanas for the first time. That, yeah, it can be done. Lay people on these retreats have got those jhanas. So, maybe this is your turn this time. So, I'm talking about this to warn you, to let you know what might happen. What are you letting yourself in for by coming on a retreat with Ajahn Brahm? Okay, so that's the talk about the jhanas. I didn't go too much into the insight practices, which come afterwards as a natural course, but I'll talk about that tomorrow, because that also will start to blow your mind. And I use that word not in the old hippie sense. You are literally blowing your mind apart. That which you thought was you is going to shatter. Any questions or comments about the jhana talk? Yeah. What I actually said was not actually getting to the state, it's while you're in there. You stay for long periods of time. It just, the stability is just too intense. The most still. Well, it's very close to the stillest being in the whole cosmos. You don't move, you can't be moved. Because of its stability, it just stays there for days sometimes. Hours. You understand why? Because there's nothing to move it. There's no way of coming out. You can't be shaken. So it's actually the time you spend in there is a long time. Later on, once you get into these things, if you want to have a little bit more control, you can do this programming mindfulness. It's a standard way. If you do want to go into a fourth jhana, not have its natural course, but you know you want to come out after 2 or 3 hours, you just tell yourself, begin the meditation, I have to come out after 2 hours. And then that is enough to bring you out after 2 hours. That's how you know, meditators, they can tell themselves to actually to stay in those deep states for such a time. But I don't recommend that the first time you go in there. Get the full money's worth. You've been going for this for so many lifetimes. Who cares if you know that you're still in this jhana when the end of the retreat comes? We'll just take you back to the monastery, put you in a little corner of the room, and just wait for you to come out. And I'll take full responsibility with your job and with your wife or your husband or whatever. What happens? One of our members, he's well known to many of you, but I won't say who he is. You probably know who he is anyway. That when he was a soldier in the British Army, he used to get these terrible migraines. And he said the only way he could get past those migraines was going to these deep states of stillness. And it's because that's the pain of it, just when he didn't have a clue what he was up to, what he was doing. He said once he was on some maneuvers in Germany and he had this incredibly bad migraine, so he went into a sort of a dark shed and he told his soldiers, you know, come and get me when you're finished. And he went into deep meditation and where the migraine couldn't reach him, just deep inside. And I think he was quite happy in his little shed or barn or whatever it was. And it was time to move. So the soldiers, apparently they forgot him first of all, and then they remembered a couple of kilometers down the road, they turned around and he was still in his barn. And so they literally picked him up and just dumped him in the back of the truck. And it's only afterwards he came out of his meditation and said, "Hey, I'm in a barn, I'm in a truck, what happened?" And soldiers are not the most delicate of people. So it's just standard. You know, they can pick you up, dump you in a truck with all its noise. You don't hear a thing, you can't feel a thing. So I could. If you get into a jhana and, you know, this is, what day is today? Wednesday. Think that day we finish. I could sort of pick you up, take you down to Serpentine, leave you in a hut, and you wouldn't know anything. Last thing you knew, I said, "Ajahn Brahm just gave this talk and I just meditated. It just went so still. And, wow, I'm in a monastery and it's what? It's Tuesday already?" These are fascinating and deep stuff. Don't think that it's beyond you. Yeah.
Does the body behave itself, say toilet trained and all the rest
of it? Yeah, just everything gets very still. Fascinating that the exactly what happens to the bodily functions, I don't know, but there was one experience, and I've told this story before, when Ajahn Chah, when he was in his coma for the last years of his life, still fully alert inside, very conscious but not able to respond. And he used to go into jhanas, and we know this, because on one occasion, the monks would, and I actually came to Perth when just before he became sick. So I didn't have a chance to look after Ajahn Chah, but monks like Ajahn Yana was still in Thailand. And the Ajahn Chah would have a nurse from the hospital on duty all the time, plus about three or four monks to look after him, do the duties for him. And so Ajahn Yana told me this story, happened many times, but this was his story, that one evening while he was on duty, Ajahn Chah stopped breathing. And when you stop breathing, that's, in meditate, that's what happens when you meditate, you stop breathing. And some in the suttas, they say it's only the fourth jhana and above you stop breathing. But maybe even less, you have a much subtle breath, but this was probably a fourth jhana or above, because the nurse was there, saw Ajahn Chah completely stopped breathing and freaked out. "Ah, we've got to revive Ajahn Chah." And all the other monks, "Leave him alone, he's just in jhana," because a lot of lay people don't understand this jhana business. They get freaked out. "Ah, if you're not breathing, you're going to die. At the very least, you're going to get brain damage." And that was a big thing with this nurse. And so after a lot of argument, apparently, they came to a compromise. And the compromise was the nurse would take blood samples every few minutes to make sure that the blood was well oxygenated. And this was a fascinating finding, that Ajahn Chah wasn't breathing for quite a few hours. His blood oxygen level stayed constant throughout the time. So he didn't need actually to have any breath, because you weren't using any oxygen. You were that still. The oxygen stayed the same. Or oxygen was going through the pores, I don't know, but no breath at all. But the oxygen level never depleted. Fascinating finding. So you're quite okay. You don't need any energy in the body, any water or whatever, simply because you're so still. Fascinating things can happen with the power of the mind. I don't know if any of you saw, there was an article which people gave me in Singapore, I think. There was this yogi in the south of India. Apparently he hadn't eaten or drunk in many years. And they thought, "Oh, this is just a sham. You have to eat. At least you have to drink water. Otherwise, you can actually fast for a while, but not having any liquids in you, you soon die." So apparently he was quite famous for not doing any of this, and so they put him in a hospital, I think for a month or something? And they had CC cameras on him at 24 hours of the day to make sure that no one was sneaking any food or water into him. And I think for 30 days, didn't take any food, not even any water, no change in him at all. Because it's CC cameras, it was actually proved beyond any doubt this was happening. It defies medical knowledge. Shouldn't happen at all. But it did. Doctors were really nonplussed. Can't be, but it was there. They had people monitoring them all the time, 24 hours with the cameras, in this closed hospital suite. So these are fascinating stuff. And you think, oh, that's just those Indian yogis. But maybe today you might have a yogi from Telangana who can do the same, or from London, or from Perth, or from Singapore. Anyone else? Okay, so give it a try. It all happens just by letting go. Just let go and these things happen. It's nature. In the time of the Buddha, people did this. In centuries since, they've done it. Men, women, let alone monks and nuns. So why can't you do it? Mention the path, very simple. Let go, present moment awareness. Get silent, watch the breath. Beautiful breath, the nimittas come up, and you're just passenger on the journey. Don't get afraid. Allow yourself to go into these deep states of meditation. Yeah?
You mentioned saints, so do you think people like Mary McKillop got into jhanas at some stage?
I don't know not too much about her life, but I don't really think so, because these sort of jhanas, they're just, they're not, that's like a saint of like of compassion. This is a mystical saint. Those mystical ones, you know, like Teresa of Avila or John of the Cross, those ones. Because I mean, these days, you know, with all respect to the Catholic Church, they just give out the sainthoods, you know, like, you know, like popcorn. Yeah. Okay. Off you go then. So we've got the interviews today. I've got myself all inspired as well. I don't want to do interviews. I just want to sit and meditate. But nevertheless, I do my duty. You got the list out there. You know who's supposed to be in, so off you go. And those one.